What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Moore. We're back with Whiskey Wednesday, where we cover hot topics that affect our short-term rental investing journey. I've got Josh, Mike, and Jake all joining me. And we're going to talk about a number of different things, as we always do. We try to pull the kind of the trending topics in our real world that is affecting our short-term rental investing journey. A couple things we always like to remind you is we still have our survey out. You guys have been giving us some really good information on the survey about what you want us to talk about, the topics that we can dive deeper into, the things that you don't want us to talk about. And so we'll try to leave all of that out of there. But overall, we're getting some really good feedback, hopefully making the show better and better for you, and making it to where it's a very valuable resource. Our goal is to help you walk into this game of short-term rental investing with your eyes wide open. We're not trying to entertain you with a bunch of viral clips of things that are fun to talk about as much. We hope that it's a little entertaining while you're listening, but that's not our number one goal. Our goal is to help you walk in this game with your eyes wide open. And so that's what we're here to do. We've got a couple shout outs. Jim Banks got his property in Transylvania County, North Carolina. And so great job, Jim. Congrats. I know it's such a, you know, we always like to give those shout outs to those of you that are launching your brand new properties. We put these properties in the show notes so you can check them out. We've got this as kind of an outdoor adventure property with for fishermen, which I like a lot. And so we've got, you know, not too far away from the Asheville area, the Western North Carolina mountains. And so go check these properties out, guys. Success leaves clues. But more importantly, Jim, congratulations on the launch of the property. We know how hard that is and a lot of work that goes into it. And so now we're looking forward to a successful summer season for you. This is a summertime property. So looking forward to seeing how that goes as you launch that property. So we also are going, so a couple of things, I got a whole list of stuff. I don't know if we're going to be able to cover it all, but just kind of as a, we're going to talk about Airbnb and Vrbo, different business models, almost exact opposite business models. Is one better than the other for us as hosts? Is it better, one better than the other for guests? We'll talk a little bit about that. Josh, I'm going to come to you with that. We're going to get an update on the South Carolina bill that we talked about, I don't know, two or three weeks ago. It actually went to and got voted on, and they're hearing crickets in the news. And so we're going to get an update on that from you. We're going to talk about, we got all kinds of stuff. I'm going to talk about the national housing market, what's going on in the markets, right? What is the housing market doing? It is a very confusing market right now for consumers, right? For buyers and for sellers. And so we're going to pull up the numbers. You know, we always say, you know, that if you're really confused, just pull up the numbers. Let's look at them and try to unpack them together, peel back the layers of the onion. What does that mean for us as buyers and sellers? So we're going to talk about the national housing market. Mike, I'm going to come to you with designing the property for the wealthy. We've got we keep hearing this term K-shaped economy right now. And we're looking at where consumers are spending their money, who's spending the money, and why we need to pay attention to that while we're setting up our properties, designing those properties. If we have some time, we might dive into the new Fed chair, what we expect as far as what our predictions are for interest rates, things like that that are going on. And so we'll probably end it there. I got a whole bunch of other stuff. If we still have a bunch of time, we'll dive in. But let's start. Josh, I'm going to come to you with this one. We've got Airbnb wants to keep you close in. Vrbo kind of wants to get you caught in a web of a whole bunch of companies, right? So very different business models. And so I'm going to go to you with this one. And then let's unpack kind of what it means for us as hosts and what it means for us as a consumer and a guest on these platforms.
Right. So this one came out on May 14th from a rental scale up. So it's a week before the big Airbnb summer release. So some of the stuff here would be updated, which we talked about. I'll kind of dive into that. But essentially the first part of this, and this is something that's kind of actually big, is, you know, VRBO is part of Expedia. Right, it's part of that group, right? And typically on those earnings calls, VRBO is not the loudest voice in the room. It's just a piece of their puzzle. But for Q1, the VRBO was the biggest part of the call. Talking about, you know, first off, that from Q1 is that the total group revenue was $3.4 billion. That was up 15% year over year. And gross bookings were $35.5 billion, up 13%. Whether that's just consumer spending, whether that is VRBO, Expedia, all that big group getting some of its own fair share, that's something we'll kind of see later on. But what I really like here that this article breaks down is how VRBO is integrating with Uber and other services like that, and how Airbnb is integrating in their own way as well, but they're doing it basically in-house. So most of Airbnb's bookings last year, over 63% of bookings, were all happened on the app, right? It wasn't from the desktop. It wasn't from a third-party booking. It was from inside the app. So Airbnb is essentially building walls around their platform, from their Delta SkyMile partnerships, their grocery stores, their hotel brands, even ordering groceries, tickets to things. They're keeping it all internal. And I think what we're kind of seeing there, something that came out maybe about 4 or 5 months ago, is that Airbnb essentially in the olden days, less than a year ago, what would happen is if I was a host, I could see the guest's phone number. Right. So if there was an emergency or something, I could reach out and be like, hey, Sean, there's a major issue here. You're having a party, whatever it is. So Airbnb came in, and basically now the number you see more likely than not is not their phone number. It's essentially a number generated by Airbnb so that they can monitor these conversations. Right. And I don't see that as a bad thing per se. Right. Maybe the host and guest shouldn't have each other's phone numbers in this type of interaction transaction. I'm not against that. And I'm also not against them from them saying, hey, we're trying to make sure the host or whomever is not trying to get them to book off platform, right? We're not trying to get it to go away. When I've talked to so many of our Bodyssey members, I'm like, if you have to message Airbnb support, Superhost support, don't do it on the phone. Stay on chat, right? And the reason is we have a transcript of what was said and what was not said. A lot of times when you're dealing with a frontline employee, they don't make a lot of money, right? And if you're a problem for whatever reason, right, and it is a serious issue, and they don't want to deal with it, they're just going to try to get you on the phone and get you off the phone, because now there's no record from your end of what was said to make you happy, right? So Airbnb is trying to keep everything in-house. VRBO is trying to keep everything out-house. How does this affect, this is where we get the real fun here, how does this affect hosts, right? How does it affect us as to run their properties, whether us or property managers? And the biggest piece here, and I think we know this, we scream this from the mountaintop, all the time, but Airbnb Brian Chesky essentially said, and I'll read this exactly what he said, is he told analysts that internal data shows an inverse relationship between portfolio size and guest rating. The larger the PM gets, the worse the rating gets, right? And I think we all agree with that. I think at a certain point, no matter what level of enterprise level solutions you have for scalability, that quality is going to start to slip. And when you see those top of the market properties, we can go to AirDNA, wherever we can pull up the top of the market in these properties, and we look at those true top performers, the majority of them, and I would say 99% of them, are not ran by a major PM. And many of them are ran by individual operators or small mom and pop operators with very small portfolios, because they have the time to dial it in and squeeze out every dollar that has.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, we've been saying that forever, right? When I talk to people about running this business, being in the short-term rental game, the Achilles heel of the game is the management side of it, right? Is delivering this great experience every single time. Turnovers are happening. Customers are getting communicated with. Things are done very efficiently, but really high end. And the bigger you get, the more scale you have, the less there's things that fall through the crack. You can't communicate with every customer personally, right? You can put in a bunch of automations, but it's all computers talking to people, right? At some point. And ultimately, if you're turning over 100 properties every single weekend, the cleaning quality is probably going to, it's turn and burn. And the QC is going to fall, short a little bit on many times. And so for us, we've been preaching for this since I started investing. I've always said I like the small boutique operators, the small co-hosts that have a handful of properties, way better than I like these big, professional management companies. And, the platforms are seeing this. So how does that tie into, the business model of Airbnb, Vrbo, both of them? That's the case. That's going to be the case with both of them, right? And I think that it's an interesting model to see both of them going two completely opposite directions. Because typically when you have competitors that are major competitors, they're running their businesses pretty similar a lot of times. It's very interesting to be able to watch this where it's now, there's a web of companies in the Expedia group. We're gonna throw you from Vrbo over to here, and hopefully they'll throw you back, and we'll kind of go back and forth. But everybody's got their own brand, their own companies, their own customer journey, everything else. They're just part of this one big web, right? We see that in our world. There's a number of companies in our world that are a whole bunch of different brands, but they're really all kind of one company. And then we've got where we did that for a little while. Mike, you know, you and I, you were part of that web with Wynn Development. Then we partnered with Vodacy Design, and we're taking more of the Airbnb approach of saying, hey, listen, we're going to be a one-stop shop for investors. You know, when it comes to the consulting, the system they plug into, when they plug into that system, they've got the design, they've got the tax, they've got the financing, they've got every single piece of the puzzle already there under one umbrella. There's risks in that because one, you know, it's all under one umbrella, under one brand. And now you have to manage that customer or the customer's expectation. And all of those different companies, because they're all essentially different companies, have to live up to the brand standard, right? And when there's a big web, sometimes it's a little easier because Vrbo can say, well, if you know, if Expedia, you know, somebody else in the Expedia group screwed this up and the customer was mad at them, they're not really mad at me, right? But right. When it's under one brand, if it's all tagged Airbnb or it's all tagged Vodacy, they get mad at Vodacy, you know, design, or they get mad at Vodacy tax. They're mad at the whole Vodacy brand, right? And that's the risk that Airbnb is taking right now in saying, hey, listen, we're gonna do this all as a one-stop shop. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how that. Which one? Both of them had really strong Q1. I was trying to look at the differences in Q1 results. They both had really strong Q1 results. I think both were up about 10 to 15% ish in that range, if I remember correctly. Somebody can fact check me on that, but I'm pretty sure both of them had pretty good Q1 earnings. And so I think, you know, there's always more than one way to skin a cat. And so how does that affect us as host or guest? We'll have to wait and see. I think as a guest, sometimes it is kind of nice to have a one-stop shop. I don't have to think about it. I've already, you know, if I trust Airbnb, I trust that they've gone out and partnered with the right companies on all these other aspects of my travel needs. And I can plug right into that and I can, you know, deal with that. If I prefer to have a little bit more, like I'm a control freak and I want to make sure that I'm vetting out every single company that I use, Maybe I prefer that a little bit more.
But, you know, there is an element of this that ties into design. You know, one of the things that Josh mentioned was as you unilaterally see the quality go down as the number of volume increases, right? That same thing happens when it comes to design. We talk about this all the time when someone is looking at a property manager that has 100 or 200 or 300 homes under management, or they're looking at a mega firm. What we tend to see, the advice that is given in the way that it is decored, is to take everything to a much more monochromatic, blended vibe. If you kind of think about it in an overlay of a hotel by context, if you go to the Hilton, every room is not unilaterally different, right? It might be a different format, like a king here, a queen, a sofa sleeper, but it's the same vibe. The wallpaper is the same, the art's the same, the vibe is the same. The science behind that is no guest feeling like they're getting less than, or if you have a bad room experience or something's wrong, I can move you to another room and you don't get your feelings hurt that, I had this room and I really liked it. Now I have to be in this room and I don't like this one the same. It's the same room. We have seen that the bigger the property management component is, the more standardized the look and vibe becomes of the design. And we talk about this week to week that the more comparable you are, you're now racing to the bottom. But I understand why they do that, because now if I have something booked and the power goes out, the plumbing, there's a flood, something breaks, I can move you from one unit to the next and you don't get your feelings hurt because it's kind of net neutral, same, same. So one of the things that I would caution about jumping in line where you're just in the middle of the megalodon property management groups is you have to still push back on the way that you design your property and market your property to stand out. And I have found that many large property management firms hate that because they don't want you to stand out. And Josh, you and I have talked about this all the time. I know you have thoughts on this too.
Right. So like from the marketing side, from what we do with photos, you know, with 5SDR is we have clients, and one of the very first things when we kind of take them on to talk about a job is like, let's talk about your manager, right? Are they going to allow you to have a lifestyle photo shoot? And one of the things that we teach at Vodacy, one of our non-negotiables when we talk with a manager, when we're interviewing them, is like, are we allowed to pay for our own photos? Because we don't want your average photographer. We don't want your brand's photographer that you sold 200 properties, because we want to be the top of those 200 or whatever, the 500 or 1,000 or whatever that number is. And a lot of times those bigger box PMs, they will fight back on that. Even your Vicasas and had a brain fart in the other major one, but they evolve. They won't let you use your own photos. Yes.
Right.
Right. Because they don't want you to stand out, because if they have a portfolio of 100 properties or 200 properties, whatever it is, and everyone's exactly the same, and then yours stands out like a sore thumb, the other 99 or 199 or whatever it is are upset because they're not getting what you have, but they didn't do the work to get there.
Right.
You shouldn't have what I have. Right.
And then the property manager has to deal with those questions. And so we always say, hey, listen, we don't really like working with those bigger property management companies, but the truth of the matter is they don't like working with us either. They don't want properties that are so different and so unique and stand out and get their unfair share of business, because that's not how their whole portfolio is with these hundreds of properties. Right. And one, it creates problems where they have to listen to the other owner saying, well, why isn't my property like that? And they're like, well, you didn't do that, right? Second, they can't move people around, right? It's not, they want a commodity. They're looking for more of a commodity. Commodities work at scale, right? And that's why the best short-term rentals, why it's one of the reasons I've talked about in the past, why big institutional money does not come into the short-term rental game very. You just don't see family offices and private equity firms and big money coming into short-term rentals because it doesn't scale. You know, it scales, commodities scale. You know, the like hotels can scale because everything is the exact same across the board, right? And so short-term rentals, if you're going to be a commodity, you don't make any money, right? It doesn't, there's no money in the middle. There's no money in the commodity game. And it's kind of unfortunate that the biggest property managers, the biggest people out there that are delivering these experiences are pushing for the commodity, and it works for them, but it really doesn't. They're the only ones making money on those properties. The homeowner, the host, is not making any money on those properties. So they don't have a mortgage. They don't have all these expenses on the property. They just get paid off the top, right? If you have a business model that you get paid off the gross revenue, you only get paid if it's booking, but you don't have any expenses outside of that as far as a mortgage or operating that property outside of your labor to be able to deliver the experience. There's no risk in that, really. There's not a lot of risk in that business. And so why wouldn't they say, hey, listen, we just want the commodity. We don't care whether you're actually paying your mortgage rate. We still get 30% off of a $100 night or 30% off a $300 night. And you would think, well, why wouldn't they be motivated to do the $300 night? Because there's fewer of those properties out there anyways. And it's way easier just to go grab the commodities and take your cut off the top and then let the homeowner, which are kind of mom and pop investors. They're not, I call it smart money, because it is kind of smarter money, to be honest. I mean, not that mom and pop investors aren't smart, but they're, you know, the smart money would never allow that to be. And that's why they don't get into this game, because they also say, okay, in order for us to make money, in order for me to place $50 million, $100 million into this game or several hundred million dollars, what they would typically put into a big development or a hospitality type space in the hotel space, that you know how hard that is to do at a high level in short-term rentals? It's next to impossible,
right?
Because the money's made at the top. And we'll talk about this here in a little bit when we get to the K-shaped economy, but that's the reality of this game. And speaking of, our larger property managers, Josh, who are supporting your boy down in South Carolina that was supporting the bill that said, hey, everybody has to kind of come to us, which was what this bill was proposing. Give us an update on what happened there.
Yeah. So, you know, I'll touch on just a brief overview. So essentially one of the largest PM brands in Myrtle Beach, and it's a major market. And this is probably one of the bottom rung of guest experience, but one of the highest volume of properties, spent a lot of his own money trying to ram a bill through called HB 3876, essentially saying if you didn't self-manage your property or you were not like a certain level of property manager, you can no longer manage a property because of how much money they were losing to these smaller, you know, co-hosts and smaller brands. And sure enough, all the news, every news station, all the articles are talking about all the doom of this and how it's going to destroy Myrtle Beach. It's going to destroy, I'm in Hilton Head, destroy Hilton Head. And this bill is going to destroy all these businesses, thousands of people, and all this doom news. Well, it goes in front of committee and it just, it just flops, right? There's a big opposition on property rights. The industry itself, Airbnb, VRBO got involved. All those co-hosts had run thousands of properties, had their owners involved, right? A ton of, there's no legislative momentum. And it just kind of died quietly. And no, I mean, I had to go find to make sure that this happened because no articles covered the news that it wasn't doom anymore, right? I will say from a win for those of us who would be very anti that, this person spent a lot of his own money. So I kind of hope it hurts his piggy bank a little bit for a little while.
Well, I think that it's a win not only for the co-hosts out there and the operators that are wanting to operate at a high level and not tap into that big property management, you know, those bigger property management companies. I think one of the bigger wins is for the guest, because just like Brian Chesky said, there is a direct correlation between guest experience, inverse correlation between guest experience and the size of the portfolio that the host is managing, right? And so the bigger it gets, the lower the guest experience gets. The smaller that portfolio is, the higher the guest experience.
Something that happened literally yesterday. I was talking to a potential Vodacy member. They're interested in joining the group, right? And they've got some properties there in Maryland, right? In Ocean City, right? Great legacy market. That is about one of the older school markets you're going to find on the East Coast, right? And he's got two properties, and I go look, and they're managed. I'm not going to say they're managed by, but it's a name that everybody would know in this space, no matter where you are. And had been open for, you know, over around a year, no reviews on Airbnb, not a single review on Airbnb. And we go look through his P&Ls, with no bookings on Airbnb. And that's really weird, right? You know, we think there'd be some. We go look at the piece of the big brand he's a part of, and over 10,000 reviews, the review score 4.2. Right. None of those listings are getting found because the guest experience is so bad, and you're having to get bookings off their direct website because the OTAs won't expose you because the reviews are so bad. Right. And so no wonder your occupancy is low. And I was like, you know, first and foremost, whether you never talk to us again, maybe find another manager. Change. Right. Yeah. Like, yeah. Move on.
Awesome. Well, let's speaking of kind of markets and stuff, let's shift gears to the actual housing market, right? We haven't talked about the housing market for a couple of weeks. It's probably time where we give it a nod, and you know, this market that just feels like we're kind of treading water, right? It's one of those markets that, you know, you mentioned, Josh, if it's good news, we don't see it on the headlines. If it's bad news, we see it on the headlines. So a lot of times we're reading the headlines that are saying, you know, the markets are down, prices are dropping, they're sitting on the market longer. All of it is actually true. But if you actually peel back the layers of the onion, you're talking about like marginal, like it's really just kind of a flatline market in most of them. Very regional market, always has been. Real estate, this is nothing new. This is kind of the articles that are coming out recently, for whatever reason, they're acting like this is a new phenomenon that we have regional, like it's like, you know, you got to pay attention to the regional housing market, not the overall housing market. It's not a crash, but a regional kind of reset, it's saying. And that's real estate. I mean, that's real estate always. That's not something new. It is definitely an odd market right now. But there's one of those things that the crash is just, in my opinion, it's an almost impossible crash to reach because, and two things. One, the inventory level, the gap between supply and demand is still very, very large. It just has not caught up. It doesn't have any signs of catching up. There are some regional markets that they built out a little bit more during the COVID era than we did in certain other areas. And we're seeing some declines there. But when you're talking about declines, we're literally talking about like the overall housing market is up about 1% year over year. So about 1% appreciation year over year. The regions that are doing well, they're up like 4%. The ones that are doing bad, they're down by 2 or 3%. They're not like, there's not this massive reset of pricing. It's just kind of flatlined. But the gap between supply and demand is still really, really large. The average home price is up again year over year in the US. And so it just keeps going up. It's hard to buy a house if you don't, like, rates are high, prices are high, inventory's low. All of those challenges still exist. Foreclosures are going up as well. And so that's what you'll see a lot on the headlines is foreclosure rates are going up. Well, they are going up because they were almost non-existent for a little while. They're actually not even back to normal levels of foreclosures. But the reason is because that equity, you know, you, the thing that nobody talks about, and you hardly find it in any articles, is most homeowners in the U.S. have a significant amount of equity. Back in 2008, when we actually had a crash, that wasn't the case. Banks were lending 125% of what houses were worth. People were underwater when they started. And then when you have any sort of a correction, we also had way more supply than we had demand. Everybody and their dog was building houses. Then we lost a lot of those builders. Now we only have the national builders. We don't have the regional and small builders. And what happened is, in the real crash, people were underwater. And so when you're underwater on a home, you foreclose. You're like, hey, listen, I owe more on this than it's worth, and I can't afford the payment. I'm walking away, right? We have foreclosure crisis. We had short sales left and right. Banks were taking hits. Right now, the average American has equity in their home. So if you have equity in your home and you can't make your house payment because you lost your job and you're going into pre-foreclosure, guess what you're going to do before that sucker forecloses? You're going to sell the damn thing, right? And so just the reality is, for those of you reading the headlines, the doom and gloom, and you're worried about a crash, it's just not going to happen. And I stand by that, and I've been saying that for a long time, but I keep seeing a lot of these headlines that are just, it's like scaring people to death when you read it, the headline, and then you read the article and you're like, oh, that's actually the opposite of what the headline was saying. You know, and so I encourage people to actually read articles, look at the look at what's going on right now. It's people have equity in their homes. If you're a homeowner, you know this, you know. And so if you actually lost your job, we're having a, you know, there's a lot of people that are worried about the job market right now. And there's a lot of things, there's a big shift. We've got a massive shift in the job market, I believe, coming in the near future with AI and all the technology coming out and everything else. And doesn't mean there are some jobs that are probably going to get eliminated. But guess what? There's a whole bunch of jobs that are coming as well to be able to deal with this new technology that's coming about. So it's a shift in the job market. But if you lose your job and you own a home and you can't make your house payment, guess what you do? You sell it and you take the equity and you put it in the bank. You don't need it. It's not, that doesn't crash the market, right? And so you've got where it becomes weird is sellers are walking in and they are all thinking that they're going to get maybe more money for their house than they are going to get. And so they price it a little bit aggressively. So they're sitting on the market a little bit longer. And we are seeing the average time on the market go up. And because of that, we feel like, okay, the sellers are like, okay, maybe this isn't going to sell. And then they start to drop their price. But the minute it hits where it should have been priced originally, and really most of them are only overpricing by maybe 5%. I don't even think the average sell to list price, it's somewhere in that 95% range. And so they're only dropping about 5%. They're not dropping a ton off of their list price, but they're sitting there on that 5% high is making the buyers not buy it. When it gets in the right range, they're selling because the inventory is low. You know, this goes back to us as investors. We have to take about 4 to 6 months to buy a property. We budget about 4 to 6 months to get a property launched. So those of you that are in like most of our clients, they're high income earners. They buy these. One of the big levers they buy them for is the tax advantages. And what happens is right now there's a lot of people like, I've got time, right? We're 6 months out for the end of the year. And we start hitting the fourth quarter and everybody's rushing to buy the properties that are still available. They end up buying crappy properties because they're rushing in to save the money on taxes. Right now, you have to bank that, hey, inventory is low already. There's not a lot of choices out there right now that are good already. And so give yourself enough time to get the right properties, because the housing market's probably not going to change, in my opinion, this year. I don't think we're going to see a big spike. I am changing my tune when it comes to, and we can kind of talk about the Fed chair, but I'm changing my tune as far as my opinion on rates. I don't think rates are really going to come down much. And they're not going to come down enough to make the housing affordable again, if you will, right? So the people that are having good jobs and they're making income and they can buy properties, those properties are going to be there. They're not going to come down in price probably. And rates are probably not going to come down in a ton. I think that the new Fed chair is between a rock and a hard place right now. I think that whatever he does, people are going to not like, and it's going to be a really tough position for him over the next probably 6 to 8 months. And I don't think we're going to see a big price drop, which means you're not going to see a whole bunch of buyers come off the sideline, put that $7.6 or $7.8 trillion in money market funds, dumping into stuff right now. So you're going to have an opportunity to still negotiate and not have to compete with everybody until you get to the fourth quarter in our game when everybody wants to buy the you know, you have 100 people trying to buy 30 properties. And that happens every fourth quarter. And it, we see it all the time. So if you are going to, if you are in the market this year and you do need to do something this year to purchase a, an asset, think about it right now. So long-winded on the housing market, very weird housing market. Prices are pretty much holding. Rates are probably going to stay about where they're at. Inventory is low. Lots of people have equity. So don't sit and wait for the crash. If you find a good property that works, it works, right? Pencil it out and make it happen. But it's one of those markets that just kind of feels weird. And it's kind of felt weird for the last year, right? Anything you guys want to add to that?
You know, I don't remember the last time they said this happened, but you know, when Powell's, you know, stepped down, he didn't leave. Right. He went into a management position, which has only happened, mm-hmm. I think, one time in the last couple of decades. And, you know, he was one of the ones that pushed back a good bit against, you know, pressure from the administration to lower rates, just to lower rates. So it would be interesting to see when that, you know, that pressure is going to continue. Does he still step back into the spotlight, or is he just going to kind of like let that pressure go? He was one of the few people that did stood up and said, you know, we're not lowering rates. It's going to cause more problems. Just to lower it doesn't make sense. So I am interested to see with him in that position now, which is just unusual, what happens with that, you know, 6 months to a year from now.
Yeah, I think that I am of the camp and the belief that lower rates helps the economy. I feel like the U.S. economy is led and built not by the big seven, you know, the mag seven companies. It's led by small businesses. It's led by, you know, medium-sized businesses, and they need to be able to borrow money to expand, invest in those technologies that are coming out, hire new people, and lower rates helps with that. We always focus on just on the housing market. Obviously the housing market, more affordable housing, and the housing costs being more affordable because our rates are low, those things all help us. But I mean, we've got pretty good inflation right now because of what's going on overseas. And you know, it's a pretty hard argument to say we're going to lower rates in a pretty inflationary time. And the argument is it's all short lived, but I mean, we've been saying it's been short lived since March. So let's see where that shakes out. Right. And so you can't, I think he's going to be in a position where, I mean, really, possibly the numbers lead to a rate hike, if anything. However, that really puts the handcuffs on a lot of small businesses who would be in an expansionary time right now, especially with the new technologies, especially with the shifting of what's going on. There's a lot of opportunity for small businesses, but they need to be able to borrow money at a rate that makes sense so that they can go higher and invest in technologies, invest in equipment, all of those different things. And that really helps the economy significantly, in my opinion. And the more available capital for smaller firms, small businesses, mom and pop shops, the better the U.S. economy is. And that's who I think is getting hurt the worst. But I think it also is the trickle down effect to the major economy, you know, because I mean, it's weird right now. Stock markets, all time highs. I mean, every time you turn around, there's more highs. I mean, if you want to talk about a crash, I'm not a stock guy. So take that for what it's worth. Put a big asterisk on that, this statement right now, because I am not an expert when it comes to stocks. But my logical brain thinks if I'm going to skim some money off the top right now, that's an area where I would, and I'd be putting it into harder assets and tangible assets. Because that seems, if I'm talking about a bubble, that definitely seems like a bubble right now, but it might not be. I might be totally wrong. Again, I'm not an expert there, but it is a very, you know, it's a weird kind of economy right now. And going back into that kind of K-shaped economy that we keep hearing about, you know, it's one side of the curve is doing really good. The other side is really struggling. And so, you know, let's bring it back to short-term rentals, and back to our world and things that we actually know about. And so, but this is affecting kind of how we design properties, Mike, and I'm going to tee up with this one, but how confident are we right now, and what is our strategy? And I'll share our strategy a little bit. But one of the properties you designed recently, one of our members, I was talking to him, and he said, "Man, Sean," he said, "I'm all in. This is my third property we're doing. I've seen what's going on in the group. The first one I did myself, and I joined your group and I did it myself, and I didn't follow all the rules. I did the second one, kind of a hybrid. We hired some, you know, outside designers and kind of tried to do this hybrid approach of keep what we liked and what some of the other things we were hearing. Both of those were struggling. So this one, we bought a property, we're all in. However, you guys had to spend a lot more money on the back end to create this unique experience than a lot of people suggested. And they said, well, how much of it was value add? And he said, not much. And so, because, so I asked that because those of you listening, I'm a fix and flip guy. Those of you that are real estate investors, it's one thing if I buy a property and if I spend $100,000 on it and I'm putting a new kitchen and I'm updating the property and it's more of like I'm doing a value add to the property, updating the property, that actually, I get a return on that investment instantly, right? I'm forcing some appreciation, I'm forcing equity. I might buy a $500,000 property, put $100,000 into it, but right after that, I've got a $650,000 property, right? And so I got a return on that initial investment. When it comes to design, furnishings, creating these experiences, that's not the case. We don't necessarily, we can spend $100,000 on the design and the furnishings. That doesn't mean now I have a $600,000 property. I still have a $500,000 property. It just looks a hell of a lot better, right? And it's furnished nice. And it's got this created this unique experience. That was the case with this member. And he said, John, you know, we spent about $300,000 on this property. It was a big property down in PCB. And in fact, it was a converted duplex. It sleeps like 30 people. So it's a big property. So that number is big because it was furnishing and setting up a lot of outdoor space, everything else. Mike knows the property I'm talking about. He said, but man, I'm nervous because I just dumped $300,000 into a property and almost none of it was value add. So my property that, you know, and I can't remember the exact acquisition cost, but it was just north of $1 million. So I think it was like 1.3, but he said my $1.3 million property didn't go to 1.6 because I put the 300 into it. However, the reason I want to set this up is we said, okay, but why would we do that then, right? The question is, what the heck? That's risky, right? One of the biggest advantages we have in this game is going and understanding this economy that we're in, and the people with the money are spending it at the top. So we're going to go make sure that we have the products they want to spend the money on. And so I said, this property analyzed, and we put this property, it was generating about $120,000 a year. We are conservatively expecting, and we're already past this run rate. We're already exceeding this run rate, but we're conservatively expecting about that 280 in income. So $280,000 in income. That 280 is $160,000 jump in annual income because I made the decision to put $300,000 in the property. So it's less than a 2-year payback, and then you're playing on house money, right? And then every single year you just up your income by $160,000. As an investor, we would do that all day long, right? And so you have to look at this through that lens. And that's why I'm kind of teeing you up, Mike, before we talk about why we make these decisions and what we do. But I don't even know if it's the wealthier consumer, because we see this across the board. We see this on one bedroom, one bathroom, you know, couples retreats that we're going to go just make them way better than everybody else's and charge double what everybody else is charging. This is how we are able to do that, because there's a segment of the economy with money spending a lot of money. And selfishly, that's who we're going to cater to. And it is part of that K-shaped economy saying, hey, listen, we're recognizing people want to spend money at the top of these markets. It's also a massive competitive advantage. That's a big hurdle to jump to go compete with us in some of these markets. And it's just capital, because it's capital intensive. So if we have the ability to do it, we're doubling down, we're eliminating our competition who might not have the money to compete with us. And in business isn't really, it's not a game of this is, we're going to play fair. We're trying to get our unfair share of business. So we're going to do everything we can in our advantage. And some of those advantages is just outspending you. If I can outspend you and then the consumer wants to spend their money with me long term, that's a pretty good advantage for me. So, I don't want to tee up that everything we're doing is just dumping money toward it, because that's not what I'm trying to get at. My point is
and
sometimes that costs money to do
so. What would be a good analogy or metaphor? Let's use luxury cars. Okay. There's lots of cars out there. There's lots of car manufacturers out there. Not everyone can drive a Lamborghini. Not everyone can drive a Lexus. Not everyone drives a Cadillac. You know, people buy those vehicles because they're looking for something. They're looking either for new features, and you know, cars come out with a new model every year. There's a new Escalade, right? But every year they're putting something new in it to make you go, I'm willing to spend this money on this 2027 version because they added this, 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 and they're adding weird things, crazy things, unique things. You know, my car has, you know, speakers that come all around your head, you know, while you're driving down the car, which, you know, only a couple of car people make that. And it's everybody is adding features to try to generate more experience. Now, the question is, how do you add those features to create the best bang for your buck, right? Some people blow their entire feature budget on one area of their property, either it being a backyard or a game room, right? What we've discovered is that if we can take that same money and say, all right, this house needs a feature, it needs a draw, it needs an attraction. We can take that money and by utilizing creative strategic design, we can sprinkle wow factor, vibe, and experience in every single room of the house, which does create an unfair advantage. To go back to the car metaphor, it's like adding massagers and entertainment systems to the back seats all the way into the car. It's one of the reasons when the Grand Wagoneer in Jeep came out. They launched that car out before any other car was doing full luxury stuff on all three rows. So like if you were sitting in the way back, which is usually the sucky seat, you still had a full control panel and all this technology and a sunroof over your head in the way back, right? Like a unique feature that made people buy a marginally kind of, in my opinion, not so great vehicle for a lot of money because it had these features that kids would get in the car and go, oh my gosh, this is so cool. And the parents are like, all right, we're getting it because the kids love it. You know, we're doing that same thing. But what's really interesting, Sean, you pointed out that this isn't just about like, oh, you got to go buy a multi-million dollar home and spend multi-million dollar dollars. When we have one guy where we dropped into Branson and we did a 500 square foot, one bed, one bath, living room, dining room, kitchen combo. That's it. And it's in Branson Landing area. And we did the full Vodacy signature on 500 square feet. And it ended up being placed with a property manager there that had 26 other units in the condo and another 50 units in the market in the upper 70s. And he brought it online. He'd never worked with Vodacy, a Vodacy member before. And about 4 months in, that one bedroom was outperforming the 2 and 3 bedrooms financially in the entire complex to the point that he started trying to reverse engineer our algorithm. The problem was because we're the manufacturer of the way that we execute all of our inherent widgets and the way that we do the art and the super high-end mattresses, but at a wholesale cost, like all these different components that come in there, he finally ended up having to join Vodacy. And he said, I had to join because I could not reverse engineer all, like I could reverse engineer one thing, but then that took my whole budget away. I don't understand how you guys are doing this across an entire property to generate these results. And he finally joined and now we're doing projects for him all over. But he told me straight up that one bedroom outperformed all other 26 units, regardless of if it was a 2-bed, a 3-bed, multiple baths, patios, different locations around the property that were better because of the experience that was designed there, it was outperforming. So you had mentioned, Sean, sometimes we do cater to higher net worth individuals in their shopping where they're willing to pay more. But there's also a nuance that happens with that property you were referring to in Bradenton. He was very concerned to put this money in because he wasn't on the beach. And he's like 9 minutes away from the beach. And the concern was, I'm competing with all of these beach properties, but I want to charge beach property dollars, but not be on the beach. And what we learned was that if we created a destination, right, that transcended the beach, but then brought that entire immersive beach vibe through the investment in those, they're not enhancements to the property value necessarily, but to the listing value, right? All of a sudden, what people were saying was, if I go to the beach, I'm paying an extra $1,000 a night to stay at this property that just looks like everything else, but it's on the beach. But there's this one over here that actually saves me $500 a night that is so immersive and such a destination that I'm willing to pay for that instead of this and save $2,500 on my vacation. But the reality is that while saving $500 a night from the on-beach properties, he's $1,000 a night more expensive than the off-beach properties that people are now going away from staying on the beach to staying here because they get this entire practically resort to themselves. And there, at those same high net worth people, if you will, are actually saving money because they feel like they're getting more for their money, getting off the beach to this fully encompassing destination. And that mere fact exhibits itself on properties in the mountains where, oh no, I'm on the wrong side of the mountain and I don't have the view. Well, guess what? If we strategically create the artwork and the vibe, you feel like you have that view 24/7 by the way that we mural and do things that give the essence of that, but you don't get you're getting the people with the view dollars for your non-view property. How is that happening? We've figured out a way to do this time and time again, to create these essences, if you will, or these vibes that are generating the dollars for properties that otherwise wouldn't deserve it. And one final pin I'll put on this is art is in the eye of the beholder. Okay. What is a piece of art worth, right? And the question is what someone's willing to pay for it. There are a number of properties from Vodacy members where we came in and did a whole house execution of our design. The entire house becomes a work of art. And we have had people who went and vacation there, drop a suitcase of cash on a client and be willing to pay 20 or 30 or 40% over the market value because they wanted to own that work of art, that vacation property for themselves. Okay. Now that's not an advocation that if you do it, that they will come, right? But it is a weird offshoot that we've had happen multiple times where someone offered $250K over market value because they wanted that property and there was nothing else like it in the marketplace. So it has that year over year value and it does have that potential of when you're rolling this off to the next investor that's coming in to buy this, it does have a higher perceived value because it A, is performing at the top of the market, but B, is a one of a kind, and one of a kind things have more value.
Yeah. And that's where that last sentence is exactly why it's one of a kind. It's unique, right? As consumers, we want something that is unique, personalized, exclusive, right? It's like, it's got to be one of one. And it's really what we're trying to do. One, we have to think about the immersive experience, but when it comes to where consumers are willing to spend more money and where they're willing to it does not become a price game anymore. It does not become a commodity game because it's so different. You can't compare. It's not even apples and oranges. We're not even fruit anymore, right? It's like apples and caviar. And, you know, it's not, and so it's like every high end thing that you talked about some vehicles, but like when you talk about like the really high end, like there's a limited run of them, you have to be on the list, you get notified. And if you screw up your, you know, like there's a lot of people getting kicked off the Ferrari list because they're talking shit about the Ferrari EV that came out, right? There's like an exclusive list of, I'm not a car guy, but I heard this on another podcast, a guy I listened to who is a car guy. He's like, I'm on the Ferrari list. Like I love Ferraris. I love everything they stand for. I love the dreams they've created for young men, you know, throughout history with posters on the wall, and they build these big companies because they wanted that Ferrari, right? It's more than just a car and it's super exclusive. It's super, you know, it's like a very limited run. And because it is exclusive and limited, people are willing to pay more for it, right? And it has to be cool still. But one of the things that we have an inherent exclusivity built into our business. You know, how many July 4ths a year can I sell? One, right? How many June 4ths can I sell every year? One, right? I have an inherent exclusivity built in. And so if I actually give the consumer something that is now unique and actually looks like way different than everybody else's, the consumer is willing to spend more and sometimes significantly more than your competition for these properties. You were mentioning that beach property. One thing that didn't get mentioned is you might be paying $500 less for that beach property, but guess what you are if you're 10 or 15 minutes off the beach when you buy the property. When you buy, if you're looking at price tags on a beachfront property versus one that's 10 minutes off the beach.
Well, that was actually one of the variables of that property.
You know, so your basis is way lower and you're making almost the same money.
But he bought that house for almost like $900,000 less than any of the on-beach properties that he was looking for. So when he was looking at them, he's like, man, I'm coming out way ahead and I'm doing on beach dollars. Yeah. And that property has been a raging success.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's for, you know, break it down. If you're an investor who's not a math person, that means a lot more money in your pocket is what that means. And so it is. I think that catering to, I don't think we should apologize for it. I think it's a massive advantage. I don't think that we should hide from the fact that it is more capital intensive on the front end. You have to make sure you're getting a return on that capital, but it's not always looking at it as adding value to the property itself. How much are you upping your revenue by doing this as well, by catering to that consumer that's willing to pay you more? And it doesn't matter whether you have a one bedroom, one bath property, or you have a 10 bedroom, 10 bath property. Those consumers are there in every single segment of the market. And so I'm not saying go buy the multi-million dollar properties all the time. I'm saying cater to the top end of where the consumers are spending, whatever segment you're playing in. And that has to do with setting up unique immersive experiences, making them feel exclusive, having that limited availability, and ultimately the consumer saying, hey, listen, I'm willing to do this. Here's my money. You know, I'll finish with what Dan Kennedy always says, and always a reminder if you're in any sort of business, if you cannot make money by being the lowest priced person in the market, there is no value in being second lowest, third lowest, or in the middle. You just all of a sudden say, okay, if I can't make money being the lowest, I'm going straight to the top because that's where the money is going to be made. And we're seeing that specifically in this economy is in short-term rentals, where we keep saying the middle is messy. The middle properties aren't making money. The bottom properties aren't making money. The top properties are all the ones that are making the majority of the money in this space. So guys, we'll wrap it up. Jake, I didn't see any questions. Do we have any questions that I missed? No questions today. Okay. Awesome. Those of you that are listening, make sure that you, send in those questions to Vodacy.com, this website, support@Vodacy.com. And we'll get those questions teed up for you. If it's for any of us specifically, just let us know. And if it's not, we'll just kind of answer them as a group for you. Those of you that have not taken the survey and you're a regular listener and you like to hear different things, you want to give us your input and your feedback, it's anonymous. And so those of you we'll make sure that we do that. It's posted in the show notes. Jake's got that posted in the show notes, so you can go find that, take the survey, give us some feedback. I had one heckler online for like 3 weeks now, right, Jake? And every time I'd have a post, if you have been watching any of these, you notice that I shaved my mustache because I kept having a heckler talking about how bad she hated my mustache. And so I shaved my mustache today. That heckler was posting anonymously, but didn't realize that her profile's still on there. And she happened to have my last name, same last name. And I sleep with her every night. So her opinion kind of mattered. Normally I wouldn't give into the hecklers, but the mustache is gone. So you're welcome, Teresa. So we do read the feedback, even if it is trying to be anonymous, but we'll wrap it up for the day. You guys, always as a favor, we try to get this show growing. We don't run ads or sponsorships. If you like it, leave us a review, give us a thumbs up on whatever platform you're watching or listening on. If you have more than 30 seconds, those things really, really do help us. And the final most important thing I ask you at the end of every episode, pick that one thing you can do today. Start building that life you don't want to take a vacation from. Cheers, my friends. Cheers, boys.
Thanks Cheers. For joining us on this episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution podcast. Share this with other people you think need to hear about it. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. Hey Grace, is there a website? Yes! For more amazing content and expert advice, visit Vodacy.com. Thanks for listening and we'll see you on the next episode.